Quartison pointed out to me just an excellent verse. It's in 2 Corinthians 13, verse 8. When we're talking about contention and controversy, Paul writes, and I won't deal with the context here, "For we cannot do anything against the truth, but only for the truth." It's akin to his writing to the Philippians, chapter 1, 15 to 18, where he says, "I'm in jail and some are preaching Christ to make me afflicted. And they do it out of contention, but whether it's out of contention or whether it's out of good motives, I rejoice because at least Christ is being preached." Concerning the issue of paid ministry, one of the reasons I raised it is because it was publicized. It's been in print, and it's a direct charge on our community, and I think it's a responsibility for brethren to investigate such serious charges. In fact, I've talked to some of the people involved in it, and I have in fact corresponded with them, so I just wanted to alert you that it wasn't setting something up just to attack. One of the references I was making in it, I had said 1 Corinthians chapter 6, 16. It's actually 1 Corinthians 16, 16. You'll understand the embarrassment if you find out what's in chapter 6, 16. Basically what it says, it was, "Should we support such workers or laborers?" And the verse reads, "I urge you to be subject to such men and to every fellow worker and laborer," and it's in the context of giving the contribution to the saints in Jerusalem, so it's a monetary matter, but also for Timothy, "When he comes, put him at ease among you, for he's doing the work of the Lord as I am." And I think putting him at ease doesn't necessarily make him feel comfortable in your conversation, as it is, you want to put him up, you want to take care of him. And finally, for the list of suggestions that I gave yesterday, at least for how to things to go about in discovering your Bible, please take that as a guideline, not as a directive. You know, it's a list of suggestions to consider. These aren't the step-by-step things to go through. In fact, I know some of you will have discovered, if you're planning to get the tapes, there is a lot of information on the notes, and you really need to have a copy of that. And if anyone orders these tapes and doesn't have the notes, they can order them from WCF. I think they're kind of important. Obviously, I haven't taken the time to read through the points. That's just supplemental information. You won't necessarily have the totality of things on the tape. So yesterday we determined that truth confronts. That is, it challenges each person who comes into contact with it. We know that the Bible obviously challenges the reader. Obey the word of the Lord. And Jesus certainly challenges his disciples. You know, if any man would come after me, let him take up his cross and follow me. And God definitely challenges people. In Malachi, "Put me to the test. See if I will not open the windows of heaven for you." And yet in the challenge is the appeal to investigate, and thus truth invites investigation. And yesterday's class also began to discuss how you can determine the validity of a viewpoint by measuring it against your own Bible understanding, something that you can and should do. Today we'll build on that and discuss specifically what I mean by validity and how to develop a valid argument using relevant Bible evidence. Let me give you some definitions. Argument: a reason offered in proof for or against a thing. From argue, to prove by reasoning, to discuss, to persuade by debate. Valid: sound or well-grounded, capable of being justified. Evidence: that which makes clear to the vision, obvious, ground for belief. Testimony, proof, information in a case, attestation, corroboration. Relevant: bearing upon the case in hand, pertinent. Now, sometimes when you hear this word argument, you say, oh no, they're a fight. I mean, this is the verbal fisticuffs here. Well, let me issue a preliminary caution here. When we argue, we shouldn't presume that because we are a, say, Christadelphian, that we're right, because we happen to have that label or position. We found out from yesterday some of the fallacies. Because you have a certain label or status, that isn't what makes you right. It's whether you can adduce the best or the better Bible evidence. So you must be willing to demonstrate the correctness by developing and presenting valid Bible evidence, and be willing to defend your case by relevant references and or examples. Now, in argumentation, there's a plea I would make as well. It's a plea for gentleness. Now, Paul is an excellent example of this, I think. Through the Acts, we find that he was arguing, pleading, debating for the sober truth. The references there are Acts 17:3, verse 17, 18:4, 19:26, 24:25, 26:25. He explains, proves, confronts. And yet he wasn't hostile or abusive in any of these things. When they had the big showdown in Acts in Ephesus, he was exonerated. He never brought anything upon any bad sayings against the Diana, the false goddess, and the people itself. And that's in Acts 19:37 and 23:29. So in spite of the hostility that Paul encountered, he would write this, and he writes it to Timothy. 2 Timothy, you might want to look this up, but I'll read it. Verses 23 to 25. And I know it's been referred to already in this Bible school. Have nothing to do with stupid, senseless controversies. You know that they breed quarrels. And the Lord's servant must not be quarrelsome, but kindly to everyone. An apt teacher, forbearing, that is, being patient, correcting his opponents with gentleness. God may perhaps grant that they will repent and come to know the truth. Now, this is important. Sometimes this is read as, we're talking about opponents who need to repent and come to knowledge of the truth. Therefore, this must apply to our conversations with people outside the Christadelphian community. Well, that's not true. The context of this is how Timothy is dealing with the problems in the ecclesia. So it certainly refers to our presentation of our beliefs to people outside. In fact, this is somewhat ironic. You may have perceived this, but for example, we might have an individual come to our ecclesia and visit, and we're kindly, and we fall over them, and we welcome them, and so on like that. But if there's someone from another ecclesia, or horrors, another fellowship that comes and sits there, you wouldn't give them the time of day. Pretend they're not even there. Cold. Hostile. And that's not right, is it? This says we shouldn't be that way. Certainly if they're wrong, in whatever state they are, we are to, because we're under an obligation here, behave this way towards them. So finally, in talking about argumentation, an exhortation for humility. You and I, when I say you, I'm talking about myself here, should be willing to acknowledge that the wholeness has not been mastered, which is a very fancy way of saying you don't know everything, and that a better understanding of a subject is always possible. Now, I've got another handout. I'm waiting until now to give it to you, because it's a two-sided handout. If I can get a couple of helpers. What you want to do is look at the sign that says ways of reaching a valid conclusion. And although it might be really difficult for you, don't turn it over and look at the other side. This is an exercise in self-control. What this page is, are some things. Again, this is not a comprehensive total list, and you shouldn't go away feeling, ah, now I've got it down, I know just follow these steps, and I never have to think about it again. Not so. These are suggestions. Basically, it's in two parts on this page. The first, and I've got them itemized from A to J, these are examples of what I mean by evidence and argumentation. And then the second part is I've tried to illustrate what I mean by the foregoing. And at the bottom, I talk about some approaches that I'll talk about in a moment. Let's just go through that from the top. Explicit text, which includes the terms or ideas under consideration. And the example I'm going to be using through all this is using the serpent. And what I mean is, when you look up the verse in the argument, it should use the term serpent in the verse. That's explicit. It's got the term in it. B, definitions given in the text itself or from the same author in a similar context. And all those points are true. An example for this, that the serpent being a literal but subtle creature, it says so in Genesis 3. Symbolically, the deceiver of the whole world. And that's explicitly given in Revelation chapter 12. Now, in dealing with this term devil, it's used as a label, described as the accuser of our brethren. That's in Revelation 12. We have other places where definitions are used. Judas is a devil. Women slanders, right? Now, point C, original language meaning as verified by Bible usage. And I've listed there the Hebrew terms for serpent and also the Greek one. Interesting, when it comes to devil, it's only a New Testament term. It's not in the Old Testament. But they are distinct terms with distinct meanings, although obviously they have a connection. Point D. Multiple lines of confirmation from context, that is the immediate verses around a passage, and cross-references. Here's where your marginal cross-references and your notes that you take from Bible schools and Bible classes, these are wonderful things to have. And for examples here, it's the serpent is a deceiver and an accuser, it says so in Revelation 12, a liar and a murderer from the beginning, John 8, a lawless one from the beginning, 1 John 3, associated with human nature, and you see that in the equivalence of a Numbers and John passage, I'll talk about that in a moment, symbol of human nature, the seed of sin, and you get that by the equivalence of Hebrews 2 and Romans 6 and 8. So you sort of jump around and you try to put things together to see if they fit. Now there's this thing called inductive reasoning and deductive reasoning, points E and F. And it's basically how you approach something, whether it's from a set of logic rules or whether there's a number of cases that you do inference from. And the examples here under E and F, the serpent is a creature used to illustrate the innate hostility of human nature toward God. The devil is a term used to personify human nature in its various manifestations. I give the references there. And so I think the serpent is a basis for the devil. You certainly, and for sin, you get this in the Numbers 21 passage, John 3, Hebrews 2, and Romans 8. So there are passages that you've encountered before. You can see that obviously a number of these references overlap. And deductively, the temptation of Jesus, it's from within. You know, he's tempted by the devil, does it say? And yet we know from James 1, Mark 7, that all temptation comes from within, from your own human lusts and so on. So it's first the natural, then the spiritual, that principle in 1 Corinthians 15. Point G, reasoning from a demonstrably parallel situation. Jesus reasons against the Pharisees that they are in fact murderers, like their father, the devil, in John 8. And Paul is concerned that the Judaizers are the serpent beguilers. in 2 Corinthians 11. Point H, reasoning from a type or example. Jesus does this explicitly. He quotes Moses raising up the serpent in the wilderness as an example of him being raised up on the cross. And the picture that this conjures up in my mind is you have a dead serpent on a pole. And Jesus equates himself with a dead serpent on a pole. Now the equivalency between those two has far-reaching consequences, which I don't propose to go into. Point I, harmonizing with previously known or agreed upon texts and doctrines. An example here, Adam was the one that brought sin into the world, not the serpent and not the devil. It's a well-established teaching, I think. Romans 5:12 says it explicitly. And J, it doesn't conflict with established first principles. And this is a good one. The illustration here is we know that God takes full responsibility for all the evil that's in the world. Not sin, but all the evil that's in the world. And I cited Isaiah 45:7, which in the Authorized is clear, and Amos 3:6, which talks about, is there not evil in a city? And there's a number of passages like that. God says, I bring evil upon mankind. He does this in the context of dualistic deities that the Persians had, a god of good, a god of evil, a god of light, a god of darkness. And God said, there's only one God, and I do them both. Therefore, and this is in the argumentation against a devil, which is kind of a pseudo-god, it isn't any devil running around that causes evil in the world. God says he does. So, points A through J are some ways that you could identify valid evidence and string them together in an argument. And there are some basic general approaches, and I know virtually all of them I got here, except possibly the last one, have been discussed here at the Bible school over the years. This deductive versus inductive reasoning, I know, has been talked about. Who will forget Brother Todd Treadway's explicit versus implicit classes? Techniques, asking the right questions. This is something that Brother Whitaker presents in his Exploring the Bible. Using the right model. This is a good example by David Levin. Let me illustrate, because not all of you would be familiar with that. He said, you've got right doctrines and right behavior, and they're kind of on a teeter-totter with a fulcrum in the middle. Now, which is more important, right teaching or right behavior? How do you balance it? Where do you put the fulcrum? The trick with this is it's the wrong model. That is, the Bible doesn't present truth that way, as behavior and beliefs. Now, it's true that belief and behavior are together, but they're not put in a balanced situation. Truth is presented as a tree. All the fruits of the Spirit are here. It's rooted and grounded in love. So that's a model, or the picture that the Bible presents. And so we, although it's convenient for us to have little models or pictures to help us understand, we need to make sure that we are not introducing an inappropriate model or a skeleton or structure or paradigm, whatever term you want to use, when we come to look at Scripture. Now what I've done is I'm now going to introduce a term that some of you will have already known from my Ezekiel study, but it's a term I call goodness fit. That is, how well does the conclusion you're proposing, or argument you're proposing, fit with other known information? Does it fit the pattern? Is it the same as others? Does it ring true? And there's some corollaries to this. One measure of it is, if this is true, does it lead to confusion or inconsistency or even to an absurdity? Now that's one logical thing. If you can take someone's argument and syllogistically go through the logic rules and end up with an absurdity or a known falseness, you can say, aha, the conclusion is false, therefore you go back and you knock out the initial premise and defeat a person's argument. Is the explanation unnecessarily complicated? If it is, and I find this in myself, if I start blathering on here and multiplying words, it shows that I've got a confused mind, which is true, and it shows that I don't really understand it that well. And when you find something that comes across complicatedly all the time, like it might be me and it might be you, but if all the time is that, it sort of says, this probably isn't quite right. It's got to be an easier way. Now, I say that notwithstanding, remember we had yesterday, truth is complex. It's got many angles, many approaches. There's only one truth, and that is unchanging, because God is one and He's unchanging. But the way we, as human beings, approach it or understand it, there's a multitude of ways there. So you can still find simple things and layer them on and come up with a complex situation. And finally, is the interpretation dependent on information outside the Bible itself? That's what I mean by extra biblical information. It isn't extra Bible information, it's information outside the Bible. So, I tell you all that so I can do my little comparison here. Now, those of you who were here at the introduction talk, I will try in 4 minutes or less to describe what I'm trying to say here. This was some of the conclusions that I determined after reading the Columbus article, looking for the true landfall, which is totally inconsequential, but it's not a bad model for me to use. Contenders for this, they just blew the other guy out of the water by saying, that's obviously wrong, we don't even have to consider that. They brought in an expert who was a biographer of Columbus, and he said, there's one and only place, it's Watling. He's a scholar, he published the stuff, he sailed through his Bahama tract once, and he looked at the various localities, and that looks good, and he wrote it up. And he assumed that the going across the Atlantic Ocean, that there was negligible effect by wind and current, and he just happened to be an admiral. And there are two other guys in the same status as him. So the case was shut. Until ordinary people came along and said, that isn't right for these reasons. And by the time it was all over, their proposal said, we'll take Columbus's log and translate it for ourselves to make sure we got all the right base information. They found independently two sources of the exact measure of the lead in terms of nautical miles. They decided you have to account for the current and the leeward drift. I mean, that's real life. You can't say it's inconsequential. It is. So they took all their figures and they adjusted them. They reconciled them by all the Columbus sightings of latitude and longitude. They used computer simulation to crank out these numbers, and also they had these maps and simulated where the outer loops were, what probable forces were. And they sailed their proposal several times, and they stopped, got out, went in the island, took the sightings from the beaches, and dug out places in the sand to see whether this is right. They cross-checked all of this from a certain cross-fix that was common ground to everyone. They came up with this being the answer. Plus, what they're going to do is confirm by building a whole weapon again, starting off from the Canary Islands and sailing and seeing where they end up. They might pull to some other island. They don't know either. But they're willing to have it checked out. And what I was trying to deduce from this is, just because it's in print by scholars doesn't make it right. Now, this is not shabby work. Don't get me wrong. And they did the right thing. This was the best information they had available. And they fit a lot of the points to it. No, he went out and he checked it. He sailed through the track. That's all right. But it turns out that there is a better way of looking at the situation. Now, they got computers down here. They didn't have any computers back there. They didn't have simulation graphics. But we got better tools, so why not use them? I mean, truth invites investigation. So here was something good.
He didn't have that before. Morrison did. Now they got some real measures. They got a critical piece of information that was missing before. One of the reasons why he didn't want to make an adjustment, that's a lot of hard work to go through every one of those daily sightings and translate them and reconcile them. That's a lot of work to do. They said negligible, but it isn't. So we got the tools to do it. Hard evidence, they went through several times to do it. Check it out. Cross-reference, match it. And what this, in my mind, is a demonstration of goodness fit. This fits a lot better than this. With the caveat that maybe when they do it from the original, all of the parameters are the same, they might even find a better site. Not that it makes any difference in that case.
So they're still willing to investigate the matter. Well, now is where I'm going to get some participation from yourselves. And this is why I wanted you not to turn over the sheet. So if you've turned it over and are peeking at it, turn it back over so you won't know this. I'm going to apply this goodness fit model to understanding some of the things in the book of Revelation. So you ready? First question, and this is one of our guidelines, what did the book mean to the original recipients? It's my general question. And actually, you don't have to answer a couple of these things here. These are going to be more rhetorical for the first part. Verse 11 in chapter 1 says that the whole book, it isn't just seven letters that were sent to the seven ecclesia, to write in a book and send it to the seven churches. It was events that would soon take place, verse 1 in chapter 1, and that in fact the whole book had to be understood and applied by the seven ecclesias is confirmed by Revelation chapter 22, verse 16. Testimony for the churches. All right. The evidence there, the whole book is relevant to the initial hearers. Since that's true, if the traditional continual historical approach is correct, then the original recipient of the book, his understanding of Revelation would be the futurist interpretation. Right? That's syllogistic logic, and you can't get out of it. But so what? I mean, what have I proven there? All I've done is taken maybe a little point and said, all right, the guys who first got it, if everything is really all future, as demanded by continuous historical, then they have a futurist outlook. Oh, that says, well, of course. There's nothing wrong with a label called futurist, or praetorist, or continuous historical. Because you have any one of those interpretations, doesn't make you right or wrong. We just use it for convenience. But sometimes, and it's been in print, that they say whoever is a futurist is bad. And they got all these connotations that they built on it. Well, brothers and sisters, the original recipients, if continuous historical is right, were all futurists at the beginning. They had to be. That's what logic will lead you to anyhow. But much more relevant, what information, and here's where you can participate. If you were a believer in Ephesus, first century, regardless of the date of this, because there's two in the AD 70 and AD 96, because it's a time of persecution, what information would you have to understand this book when you got it? So you got the book, comes in. What other information would you have in your ecclesial bookstall or in your home library to check this out? The new, at least the early Gospels, I think, which means you'd have a copy of the Olivet Prophecy, right? What else would you have? You know this from your Bibles. You have people with the Spirit, divinely inspired people around that could help you check it out, right? Apostolic input, all right? So there might be some people that will help you understand it.
I'm thinking of some tangible evidence. Go through the 66 books of the Bible, starting from the New Testament, and there is one thing there that would probably glue you in. Now, there are Paul to the Ephesians. I mean, you've got to be stacked. And an event took place in Acts where your elders went to talk to Paul, right? Acts chapter 20, where Paul tells them things that are going to happen in the future. So if you got the Old Testament prophets, and if you got the Mount Olivet prophecy, you got apostolic input from Paul, who's given a warning, and he's got that in a letter that he's written to you, and he's got the advice to your elders who are there, and you may have had Timothy on or off the spot. You've got a lot of things going for you. And suddenly you get this book. It's got specific information for you and your ecclesia, you're the first one, but the whole book. How do you fit that information? Things shortly to come to pass. Well, I think that their connection, say, with the Mount Olivet prophecy and how Jesus outlined that, he talked about a lot of things that appear in the book of Revelation in a very abbreviated form. And one of the things he obviously talked about in the Mount Olivet prophecy was the impending overthrow of Jerusalem and all the ramifications of that. So one piece of information, and you see this in my notes, this might be a good point to consider if you were a first century believer to understand what this book meant, and may in fact help determine how we should date the writing of Revelation, whether it was an early AD 70 date, which would then allow for the fall of Jerusalem interpretation, or whether it was a later one. Which interpretation better fits the evidence? Now, a second area. We know that Revelation is a book of symbols. Apocalyptic is a term we use. If you were to pick one prophet or book in the Old Testament that provides the most clues or keys to understanding the book of Revelation, what would you choose? I'll listen to some suggestions. Daniel? And who is another? Ezekiel? Oh my, do I like you. Daniel, many, lots and lots of Daniels and one lone Ezekiel voice, and you weren't even at Bloomington. Oh, do I like you. It's so good because you're going to lead into my point here. Obviously, Daniel is a source. I mean, you got the beast, they come right out of Daniel, and you got the time periods. You got Michael the archangel, you got these pictures of angels, the manifestations of the angels, whether it's from chapter 1 or chapter 10. And by the way, if you're not too familiar with the contents of the book of Revelation, that doesn't matter. You don't have to know that to understand what I'm saying here. But after that, there's not a whole lot that Daniel really says that is explicitly or even implicitly brought up in Revelation, except that there's going to be a kingdom and so on. However, when you look at the book of Ezekiel, you start at chapter 1, 2, and 3, and suddenly you get whole chapters, multitudes of references. In fact, my study on it, there is probably only 5 or 6 chapters out of 48 in Ezekiel that did not have a specific tie-in with the book of Revelation. And one real good example is John is in Patmos in exile. Ezekiel is in exile, isn't he? We know what Ezekiel's message is. He's outside the land, writing to people who are also outside the land. And what's his subject matter? The impending fall of Jerusalem. The Gentile overthrow, the repentance, and the restoration of Israel. He's caught up in the spirit of the Lord's day. You see all these visions of the cherubim. He sees heavenly Jerusalem. Later on, he sees this temple. Just multitude of things.
John writes to ecclesias who are outside the land, and now this might begin to be the pattern, what can be, what could be his subject matter. It could be, if he's patterned off of Ezekiel, talking about the impending destruction of Jerusalem and the Gentile oppressor and their repentance and their eventual restoration. And I think there is a much better goodness fit between Ezekiel and Revelation than Daniel. Daniel isn't inconsequential, don't get me wrong, but Ezekiel is a much better fit, provides what I think a much better pattern, and we will see this in a moment or three. Conclusion of that point, however, is there's a pattern that is helpful. Just like the Mount Olivet prophecy has at least two applications, whether you take the whole prophecy and apply it twice, first to the initial hearers and then to the last days, or only go through part of it and say that applied to the first century and the last part, the last days. That's the parousia, the book of Revelation. It's Jesus' prophecy in the book of Revelation, and there's all kinds of correspondences between the two. We would expect, therefore, to have more than one application of the book of Revelation, and Ezekiel, therefore, is supportive of the Olivet prophecy, which makes that dual application a good fit. Now, here's something for you to answer. In the book of Revelation, who is the real enemy of the believer? What is the enemy defined as being in the book of Revelation? The beast, that's one candidate. Anybody else? The beast persecutes the saints. That's a good choice. Any other suggestions? Dragon. And I believe that that's right. And it's in chapter 12. In fact, the text says so explicitly. And the reason I felt that this was a fair question is we just went through all the references in the handout on the front side, right? What does it say? It's talking about the war in heaven. Verse 9, and the great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth. And he's described further in verse 10, the accuser of our brethren has been thrown down. He accuses them day and night. And how was this dragon, devil, serpent conquered? By the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, for they love not their lives even unto death. Now, if you can get out of your mind whatever you think chapter 12 means, because it's highly symbolic, you don't have a great red dragon with these seven heads and horns and throwing down a third of the stars of heaven. It's obviously a symbol of something. But we got the text defining what it is. It says it's the ancient serpent. It's the Genesis serpent. By the way, it's called the devil. Oh, it's also called Satan. It's the accuser of our brethren. And this is a symbol for sin, isn't it? So the real enemy in the book of Revelation is sin. Where does sin dwell? Right here. That's the enemy, the real enemy in the book of Revelation. It's always been that way from Genesis, and it's that way in the book of Revelation. Why then do you think that someone would take Revelation chapter 12 and not emphasize that point? This is the first principle, isn't it? So they certainly could have understood it that way in the first century. We can certainly understand it that way. And alternative interpretations, and I'm going to dispute whether they're right or wrong, if they don't get this first principle emphasized and say, here's the real enemy, not the beast, not some political power, not some perhaps arguable religious system. That's not the enemy of the saints. The enemy of the saints, the enemy of the believers is yourself. That's what's conquered in this book. So what I'm saying,
if of all the chapters, I think chapter 12 is one of the most symbolic ones, but it defines itself. I mean, the definition is really clear there, I think. And we don't have to go outside the Bible to figure out what this is talking about. It tells us itself. But you might be thinking, what about the harlot and the persecution of the saints? Got the blood of the saints in her. That's what it says. The beast is also persecuted the saints, by the way. And the harlot is never said to be in alliance with the beast, although it fornicates with it and the kings. And there's this said about the harlot. And I'm going to cite some verses here. Chapter 17, verse 5. Actually, it's verse 6. Saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And verse 24 in chapter 18. In her was found the blood of prophets and of saints and of all who've been slain on earth. Where must every prophet be killed according to Jesus? He said a prophet, it cannot be that a prophet die away from Jerusalem. Matthew 23, verse 37, confirmed in Luke 11, verse 50 and 13:33. Now, this great city in the book of Revelation, described in chapter 11, verse 18, says, chapter 11, verse 8, and their dead bodies will lie in the street of the great city, and this is where the two prophets were killed. Chapter 11, the two witnesses, the two prophets, lie in the street of the great city, which is allegorically called Sodom and Egypt. Allegorically called Sodom and Egypt. You need to find some place in the Old Testament where a city is called Sodom or Egypt. You might look at the reference in Isaiah chapter 1 of that. But in case we couldn't find those, it says, where their Lord was crucified. And what's the answer to that? Okay, that was pretty easy, and you're right. Now, regardless of any interpretation of the book, you've got these facts. I mean, these are facts, Bible facts, and you need to fit your interpretation around them. If you're just reading the book, and you come to chapter 17, you come across a woman, verse 3, sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of blasphemous names and had seven heads and ten horns. And John, to see this, is carried away into the wilderness. Where, if at all, do you encounter a woman in the book of Revelation previous to this? It's in chapter 12. And you left a woman in chapter 12 fleeing into the wilderness. So you pick her up again in chapter 17 as being in the wilderness, and it's a woman. You would think then there's an obvious connection between the two, and there are. So again, any interpretation must make that connection. How is the woman described in chapter 12? Well, you take the symbolism of chapter 12, clothed with the sun, moon under her feet, 12 stars associated with her. Where in the Bible do you start getting that terminology? And you can see, again, there's at least an Israel connection. There might be more, but there's at least that. Now, one other thing. When the harlot is destroyed in chapter 17, it's destroyed by the beast and the horns. It says so in verse 16. They're devoured, desolated, burned with fire. However, in chapter 16, the great city is destroyed by the great earthquake, which splits it into three parts. God remembers great Babylon to make her drain the cup of the fury of his wrath. Now the question to ask, are these destructions the same, or are they different? If they're different, then how do you account for the difference? Well, I'll leave you hanging on that one. Babylon is said to clearly represent Rome because of the Seven Hills characteristic. And Rome is the only reasonable city that has that characteristic. And notwithstanding what some brother has suggested, that Jerusalem might be sitting on hills and tries to scrounge up a seven, that doesn't satisfy nearly enough, as Rome being probably the best candidate. Mind you, that interpretation of Rome being that characteristic, I think it happened many years after the book of Revelation was said. But look at what the book says. It says, seven heads represent seven hills. They also represent seven kings or kingdoms. It says five are past, one is, and one is future. It goes on to say, because the woman is seated on the hills, it's equivalent to many waters, which are interpreted in the text to mean peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. In other words, the text, in talking about seven hills, is not referring to topography at all. It is not talking about seven literal hills. These are symbolic of something. And what are they symbolic of? The text says, many waters, that is, peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues, as distinct from Israel. These are Gentiles. Well, how does that fit with these seven kings or kingdoms? Five past. It's not too difficult to find five kingdoms or empires prior to Rome. Rome would be the one that is, and you start going backwards. What would they be? Medo-Persia, right back in Greece, Medo-Persia, Babylon, Syria, Egypt. All Gentile oppressors. One future, one to come, one last day application that we don't know. And a critical point that is often not perceived. Where is the harlot seated? She's on the beast, right? On the back of the beast, right? Wrong. It's on the hills. But the hills are the heads. The woman's on the heads, where the horns are. And that's what destroyed her. It is not a picture of a harlot woman in control of the beast, but a harlot woman who is about to be destroyed by her lovers. And that's a very different picture. The text says so. This is not my interpretation. So, given those facts, what is a goodness fit? Well, let's look at Ezekiel. Ezekiel says something about harlots and the land being the mother of harlots in chapter 16. Ezekiel says a lot about a harlot Jerusalem being destroyed by her lovers. So there's at least two real clear connections with that. Jeremiah 25 talks about a cup of abominations, a cup of fury that starts first with Jerusalem and is handed around to all the Gentile nations, and Babylon is the last one to drink it. Ah, so there's a distinction between Jerusalem and Babylon, and that's right. It certainly was historically, but it gives us a clue as to the two destructions of Jerusalem. Because if you've got a Jewish-occupied Jerusalem that's destroyed by her lovers, as one in Ezekiel, and the beast takes over. The throne of the beast is set up. It's Gentile occupied. It's Babylon. Babylon aspect then is now not Jewish, but Gentile. When Christ comes back, Mount of Olives, split, it is the throne of the beast that's destroyed. It's the Gentile aspect Jerusalem. And that's the chapter 16 destruction. There's other things that I could adduce to that, but basically, I think I'm 1 minute over time. Let me take one more minute here. Those are some facts to fit. I think there's a goodness fit for Jerusalem and the harlot here. But the point of it, the real enemy then, is not some system. It's not a political system. It's not a religious system. It's in ourselves. Jesus, Mount of Olives, prophecy, Matthew 24, Luke 21. Matthew 24 three times says,
watch out for false prophets. They can deceive even the elect. And I'm not trying to minimize that. There are false religious political systems. There are apostate people. I'm not trying to say there's not. What I am trying to point out is the personal application to ourselves. And Jesus, in his Luke 21 discourse, put it this way. But take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with dissipation and drunkenness and cares of this life, and that day come upon you suddenly like a snare, for it will come upon all who dwell upon the face of the whole earth. In other words, watch the real enemy yourself. How do you watch it? Watch at all times, praying that you may have strength to escape all these things that will take place, and to stand before the Son of Man. You can turn over your sheets now and see what I said.